America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We see major assemblies of leaders from around the entire globe setting targets for lessening our reliance on fossil fuels, which has hastened global warming and cataclysmic weather events. Often those goals are agreed to, but never met. On the ground, neighborhood by neighborhood, people are taking matters in their own hands and making their communities more resilient in the face of deadlines scientists say are drawing ever closer. Let's get inspired to do the hard work of change in our own communities. That's today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Allison Sant. She's a partner, co-founder of the Studio for Urban Projects, an interdisciplinary design collaborative based in San Francisco. It works at the intersection of architecture, urbanism, art, and social activism. There's a lot to be said about what you're working on, I've got to say this. But Allison, you've written a book, you've edited a book, you've had a lot of contributors to this book, and it's called From the Ground Up: Local Efforts to Create Resilient Cities. And what I found very interesting in some of the introductory material was the fact that by 2018, you tell us, 83% of the population lived in just 3% of the U.S. total land area, and that most of the urban areas were responsible for about 75% of the global carbon emissions. That's pretty astonishing.
What it does is create a great context to act, because with so many of us living in cities, we know that the decisions that we make in cities matter. So when we reclaim our streets from cars to create safe places to walk and bike and more efficient public transit for everyone, we lower carbon emissions. When we tear up the concrete to create green streets and rain gardens to slow stormwater and floodable parks, we're preventing extreme floods, but we're also making the places that we live lush and alive. When we plant cities with street trees and expand our urban tree canopy, we're sequestering carbon, we're reducing air pollution, and we're cooling our city streets. And then when we adapt our shorelines by restoring wetlands or installing oyster reefs and other nature-based solutions, we're buffering future storms. And as the book describes, this work is already underway in cities across the country.
But I've got to ask you, I just read a piece in the New York Times by Thomas Friedman, and let me quote a little bit. "We are out of harmony with each other and out of harmony with nature unless more people take principled stands against those who are undermining truth and trust. We simply will not have the tools we need to roll back extreme politics or extreme weather or extreme pandemics." And he goes on to talk about the fact that lately we started to see weather events that are not just extremes, but super extremes. We're talking about 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the Arctic, a polar vortex freezing Texas, on and on we go. I guess my question is, because the federal government, to some extent, was dormant for a period of time as it relates to climate change, because it's been very much politicized within the United States, how far behind are we, as valiant as the efforts that you document are?
Well, I think now is the time to act. And, you know, we often think of powerful governments and the regulations and legislations they enact being the central tools of change. And they are. But the opposite is also true. For these policies to succeed, they really need to be led from the ground up. and led by people who know their neighbors and their neighborhoods. In doing that, we can actually be much more effective in deploying these kinds of solutions. In the book, I look at several communities, for example, in the 7th Ward of Louisiana, and I'm sorry, in New Orleans. There's been a collaborative group called WaterWise, and they have worked with communities throughout the city, one of which is in the 7th Ward, where a woman named Angela Chalk is the executive director of Healthy Community Services. After Hurricane Katrina, which we know was devastating to New Orleans, she worked with WaterWise to direct funding to her neighborhood and made sure that as green infrastructure was being expanded in the city, it was coming there. But it wasn't just a top-down process. She engaged by starting in her own backyard and installing bioswales along her driveway. And when the next storm hit and her neighbors saw that she didn't flood, they were eager to have those solutions in their yards. And the momentum grew for green infrastructure in her neighborhood. And she brought her neighbors together over home-cooked meals and knew when to hold meetings because she knew when people were busy and when they were available. And gradually, she was able to help start a movement that brought green infrastructure to the 7th Ward. She was also really interested in making sure that as her neighbors were installing green infrastructure, that they were also learning about why it worked so that they could become water literate. And a huge part of creating action is in this context of urgency is that the people that are on the ground and experiencing the worst effects of climate change are also the people that can direct the solutions for it.
I guess what I'm asking is, how much does the macro have to come together with the micro? I mean, I think some of the things that you talk about in the book are remarkable. The people are astonishing. But, you know, we have got such a problem that we seem to be looking at ways that we can forestall the problem, ways to mitigate it to the degree that we can. But we also, I think, don't have to reconcile ourselves only to stopgap, if you will. We've got to look at things that are long-term going to be much more sustainable. So how do we put those two together?
When we look at solutions, the top-down and the bottom-up are really important because the top-down solutions, for example, the Clean Water Act, which was signed into legislation in 1972 by Republican President Richard Nixon, is still creating change in cities today in green infrastructure projects. But it's also true that we need work to start from the ground up so that those solutions can fit the pace of climate change, both mitigating and adapting to the challenges ahead.
You remind us that our cities, as magnificent as they are, and you live in San Francisco, I live outside of Boston in New York. I mean, these are remarkable places indeed, but they are all built to some extent or another around the car. And now we're trying to reclaim these cities because it is car emissions that really does the largest share of emissions in the U.S. And you do talk about many projects that are going on, and we've seen it even in New York City, reclaiming various streets, making it pedestrian and bike only. But how substantial is that effort, and how important is it overall?
Transportation is a really key piece of mitigating climate change in cities. As I pointed out, that when we reclaim our streets from cars, we're not only lowering the carbon emissions of cars, we're also making way for a whole host of other things, because the amount of space that cars take up in cities is remarkable. Like 25 to 35% of many cities is taken up by parking and moving cars around. So when that space is created, you not only can create better modes of transit that don't emit carbon, like biking, walking, and public transit, but you also make room for a lot of the green infrastructure needs that you have, or you make room for public spaces that are generous enough for people to get to know one another and look each other in the eye so that we can move ahead in concert with one another. There's so many things that can come out of transitioning our transportation system away from fossil fuels. I also want to point out that transportation, you know, in a lot of neighborhoods, the people that bike and walk and don't own cars are disproportionately also affected by traffic violence. And so creating better public transit, efficient public transit, not only affords people to have access to the resources of the city and jobs and education, but it also is a really important piece of making safer streets and making them safe for everybody.
Well, part one of your book is dedicated to reclaiming our streets, and you have various projects that are going on in San Francisco, Minneapolis, New York. How exciting are those plans, and how much are they being adopted from one community to another? I know that a lot of the laboratories of democracy, we say, are our cities and states. Do we see a lot of replication going on? And would you like to focus on any one project or another that you think is really emblematic of this?
Often experiments need to start small and then scale success. And those best practices are what are being picked up by cities across the country. There's a great example in San Francisco, where I live, of parklets originated in 2005 with a group called Rebar that created Parking Day. And they reclaimed a parking spot by filling a parking meter and renting the space for a couple of hours to literally turn a parking space into a park. And they rolled out some sod and a bench and, you know, and stood back and watched people use it. And that ignited a movement of parking days, which have happened every year since. In fact, most of the people that create parking day installations today don't even know the original people that founded it or who they were. But it also has ignited a number of other projects that have been taken on by cities. So in San Francisco, the parking day actually turned into the Parklet program, which was run by the city. So no longer were we renting parking spaces for a couple of hours. They were being permitted as parks for years at a time. And in the first, I think that program started in the early 2000s, 2007 or 8, and then through up until the pandemic, there were maybe 76 parklets installed in San Francisco. Hmm. But during the pandemic, that project turned into the Shared Spaces program. And during that period, just in the last 2 years, we've had over 2,000 permits for shared spaces. And it has drastically changed the tone on San Francisco streets. And San Francisco isn't the only city that's done this. You can see it in many cities across the country, in New York especially, which also had a very extensive public plaza program that San Francisco was learning from in its own way. And you can read about it in the book, but it was the closing of Times Square and the creation of all of these small public spaces all over New York City that were connected by bike lanes. And that happened under the Bloomberg administration, but then was expanded under de Blasio. And so many cities are in conversations with each other about how to reclaim spaces for people instead of the private automobile.
Yeah, and I know that those types of programs are just so popular when they are done. The pandemic, you mentioned that. Could there be a green shoot that comes out of the pandemic after all the death and the terrible consequences that maybe fewer people are actually commuting in and out using their cars? One of the things I don't like to see here in the Northeast is the fact that a lot of our commuter rail is not being used as much. However, the good news there is that a lot of people are working from home and they are not having to make a choice as to whether to use a train or a car. They're not going anywhere. So is this one of the perhaps positive effects?
I think many of us are hoping that this is a time where we're imagining different futures, that we can reconsider how we work and how we get around cities, for sure. And I think especially in the early days of the pandemic, we saw, you know, the lowering of pollution levels, air pollution levels, and all of those things are associated with traffic. And I hope that we continue to appreciate those changes. But I also want to point out that the COVID pandemic have really laid bare the vast inequities in America's society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the last 2 years, too, with the murder of George Floyd and the reigniting of the civil rights movement, we've also continued to see how how important it is that we understand that systemic racism has really shaped the American urban landscape, and it's left many under-resourced communities and communities of color the hardest hit by the effects of climate change. And I really saw this in my research as it unfolded. You know, there's incredible discrepancies. For example, in redlined communities in East Baltimore, you can have 6% tree canopy cover, whereas in an affluent majority white neighborhood, you might have 50% tree canopy cover. And so that means that on a hot day in Baltimore, there could be a 16-degree difference between one part of the city and the other. In New Orleans, you know, race and elevation is strongly correlated. So many of the city's Black residents were condensed in the lower-lying parts of the city, which in Katrina, we saw the disastrous effects of that when the Black population of New Orleans was approximately 76% of the storm's victims. So too often, race is correlated with where people live in cities, what elevation they live at, what temperatures they're exposed to in extreme heat, and what resources they have available to them to deal with the consequences of climate change. So I think it's really important as we remember this time to think ahead to how we want to create a society that links social justice with climate action.
That is a great point. I don't think people, Allison, really have put it into that kind of focus. We hear about environmental injustice, the fact that so many of the nation's needs, perhaps, for disposal of various hazardous wastes and such end up in cities because those who are in certain neighborhoods are powerless to object. Those in the suburbs are powerful and do object. And you point a lot of this out. There's an essay by Tamika Butler in your book, and the book is called From the Ground Up, Local Efforts to Create Resilient Cities. We're talking to Allison Sant, who put the book together, who has written a good portion of it, but also given that responsibility to others. She talks about building inclusive cities from the ground up. What does that look like?
The most exciting part of this book, certainly in researching it and talking with over 90 people that I interviewed across the country, but, you know, climate solutions are really an opportunity to create equitable and livable cities. And some of the best examples that I found across the country as I was looking at projects were ones that were really holistic, that didn't look at just one thing at a time, but tried to solve multiple problems. And that's not only good for creating more equitable cities and a more equitable country in general, but it's also really important for climate. So, for example, in Baltimore, there's an amazing project called the Baltimore Wood Project. To give some context, in Baltimore, there's something like 30,000 vacant lots and buildings. And 4,000 of those abandoned buildings are slated by the city to be dismantled. And also in parts of Baltimore, there's something like 20 to 25% unemployment. A consortium was created, a collaborative was created between Humanum, which is a nonprofit organization that creates jobs and job opportunities for people with barriers to employment, the U.S. Forest Service, and the city got together and created this project. So the city contracted with social enterprise at Humanum to provide jobs to people in many of those neighborhoods that I mentioned earlier that were being redlined and have been excluded from economic benefits for generations. And they provided job training and job skills and jobs to people in that neighborhood to deconstruct those buildings. So they were carefully taking apart the boards and the bricks of all of those buildings and salvaging that material. That material then went on to be sold, and it's been sold to companies like Room and Board, who have created a whole furniture line named after the streets where that wood was salvaged. There's like the Edding bookcase and other examples like that. When I spoke to Morgan Grove from the U.S. Forest Service, he pointed out that there's more wood going into landfills in this country than is being harvested from our natural areas. And when that wood decomposes in our landfills, it is releasing the carbon that it once stored. So waste is a huge issue. By taking the wood from these buildings and reusing it, we're avoiding all of those carbon emissions. And so it's a really exciting project. One of the other pieces of it is that when those houses are dismantled, they're also making room for public parks and small urban forests that are contributing to the city's 40% tree canopy goal.
Well, of course, you talk in the book about a whole range of activities that are going on across the country. You show how cities are reclaiming streets from cars, and we discussed that briefly, restoring watersheds, reforesting urban areas, implementing large-scale ecological restoration along shorelines. Do you think that there's more energy behind any one of these at this moment in time? Are they all getting a sufficient amount of attention in major cities across the country?
Well, it's interesting. I think since the pandemic, like, for example, in New York, the biking numbers went up exponentially in New York as people stopped taking the subway and started using the bike share as an alternative. One of the ways in which we can make sure that bike share and micro-mobility and bike lanes are serving all of us is by making sure that it's introduced in communities themselves. So, for example, the book covers a project in New York City in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, that was initiated by the Bed-Stuy Restoration Group, which is a community development corporation. And they were interested in funneling the bike share system, or they were interested in expanding the bike share system in their neighborhood, which was a neighborhood that had largely been left out of efficient public transit and affordable public transit. They initiated the bike share by first exposing the people in their community through advertising and other campaigns that were already using bike share, so that people of Bed-Stuy saw a reflection of their own community in the bike share network. Then they hired local youth to become ambassadors, to interview neighbors and better understand what their needs were. They collaborated with local hospitals and had doctors write bike prescriptions, which allowed people to have discounted memberships and use bikes for general health. And they worked with the local police precincts so that they could avoid racial profiling as the people of Bed-Stuy started riding bikes more frequently. And all of these things were really critical. They created local leadership. They created some economic opportunities that could expand in the future for that neighborhood. And across the city, they saw an uptick of 56% membership in Bed-Stuy, which is more than any other part of the city. So as we look to coming out of the pandemic to other ways to get around, New York has been extraordinary in this in terms of congestion pricing and experimenting with buses and a whole host of other things. It's a very multimodal focused city, and there are other cities in the book too, Minneapolis, which also has that focus. But as we emerge from the pandemic and we're looking to build out transportation, which I think is getting a lot of attention right now, we need to do it in a way that's equitable.
And do you see that happening? For example, the infrastructure bill that has been signed into law and we are told beginning to be actualized. Do you sense that infrastructure bill is going to be an important adjunct to a lot of the activities that you document in From Ground Up?
Absolutely, and that is my profound hope. I think the key with the infrastructure bill is going to be making sure that money is being funneled to communities on the ground and not just administered at a state level, so that, you know, places like Our Streets Minneapolis, which is a transit advocacy group in Minneapolis, North Minneapolis Greenway Now folks who have been interested in creating a greenway in their neighborhood in North Minneapolis, as you may know, there are greenways all over Minneapolis that help people not only come into the city, but ride their bikes throughout the city, even in the cold winter temperatures. It's an extraordinary biking city. But North Minneapolis has been left out of a lot of the infrastructure that's created that in other parts of the city. So funneling money to groups like that that can really grow that infrastructure and get the support that they need is going to be critical as the infrastructure bill unfolds.
One of the areas that got me very excited reading in your book was about the urban tree canopy and so many projects. You in part three, you titled that Plant the City, Canopy Cover in the City of Trees in Washington, the Forest in the City in Baltimore. And I say I'm excited because at least in my state of Connecticut, we have remained a very forested state. And I think it's one of the beauties of our state and one of the reasons I'm still here. I just love all the trees here in Connecticut. So tell us how active and how important planting the city is.
Well, planting the city and expanding our urban forests is not only critical to sequestering carbon, but also cooling cities as we get hotter and hotter temperatures in the future. In the process of reforesting our cities, we also have an opportunity to expand jobs for many people living in neighborhoods that have traditionally not had a tree canopy. It's very, very striking when you look at cities like Baltimore and DC, where there's a very strong correlation between where trees are planted and where they are not. And many communities of color, communities that have been redlined, don't enjoy the same tree canopy cover in their neighborhoods. So a lot of current efforts in cities are going into more equally distributing the urban tree canopy. And American Forests, and the national group, American Forests has been a leader on working with cities across the country on creating tree equity. It's also true that there's a lot of jobs available in urban forestry. I covered a project in the book from Washington Parks for People in D.C., where there's a huge divide in urban tree canopy across neighborhoods. Washington Parks for People created a jobs training program, which is really a helpful on-ramp for people with barriers to employment to gain legitimate jobs. And they hired folks to learn how to plant trees and care for trees throughout their neighborhood and ended up attempting to equalize tree canopy in D.C. by planting in neighborhoods that have been left out of the urban tree canopy cover for years.
In the book, part four, Adapting the Shoreline, and I know people love the shoreline. Lots of people live near the shoreline. And, of course, we've done a lot for resiliency with seawalls and different building codes that if you're going to reconstruct in an area, you've got to put it on stilts or whatever it may be. I know here in Connecticut, Long Island Sound, that estuary is so important to the economic and cultural and environmental vitality of our state. So tell us, how excited are people at the shoreline to try to make themselves not only more resilient, but also really to make certain that this natural resource is really available to more and more people? We've had trouble with access issues here in Connecticut.
Yeah, there's some very exciting work going on along the shoreline in nature-based adaptation. One project in the book that I highlight is the Billion Oyster Project in New York, which took the Million Trees project idea and manifested it in the water. So it's an amazing project because they started experimenting years ago with small-scale oyster reefs. It was born out of a school on Governor's Island called the Harbor School, where students, public school students, are learning all kinds of they're learning about marine biology, they're learning about how to put together oyster cages for shell and build oyster reefs, all kinds, and monitoring. They're learning all kinds of tools that are used throughout New York Harbor in this project, including growing oyster from spat in these nurseries. And those oysters have been deployed in different parts of New York Harbor with different amounts of success. But Soundview Park was one in the Bronx where they were able to create a reef system and have steadily grown it over time. And what they've learned there in Soundview has helped them in other parts of New York Harbor. For example, they learned that by having an introduced oyster population with a remnant population, they had better results. And that has been really key in discovering other places to grow oysters in the harbor. For example, under the former Tappan Zee Bridge, they have a new colony of oysters that has been growing off of a remnant population and with phenomenal results. In fact, just over the course of researching this book, that data was unfolding, and I was very happy that by the end of writing it, that there was so much enthusiasm about that project. But it's also expanding in the living breakwaters, which is being installed in Staten Island, and potentially maybe the Gowanus Canal when it's cleaned up. But these kinds of, you know, using oyster reefs, just one example of nature-based adaptation solutions. And those kinds of things, including restored wetlands in the Bay Area, we've been trying the horizontal levee systems. You know, these are really solutions that combine approaches to nature with hard infrastructure, often to create real buffers to storm surges ahead and buy us some time to retreat in some places and make sure that we're not putting the critical infrastructure right up against our shorelines.
Well, it was a little sad to read the chapter 12 moving away from the coast in Louisiana, but yet those barrier islands have all succumbed to the rising waters. And I know people are doing what they can, and I think you're bringing out a really interesting point, which is that people are trying to marry some of the things that might feel harsh and pushing us away from the water with ways that we can use the water and all of its habitat to help us as well. So what do you see there? Because you have an essay from Christina Hill, Adapting Urban Districts to Sea Level Rise by Mimicking Natural Processes. Is that moving forward at a good pace?
Sort of two pieces to that. There's one is the idea that we create habitat, we buffer storm surge, we make our shorelines, we restore our shorelines with the natural buffers they once had. You know, much of the Louisiana coastline is being lost due to its wetlands disappearing, and partially because of the oil industry and partially because of sea level rise. But they're losing about a football field an hour of land. It's tragic. It's really important that as we consider, you know, Louisiana is a frontline community, and many of the solutions that they're developing there, other coastal regions will also face in the future. And so while I wanted to focus in the book on things like the Billion Oyster Project and a whole host of nature-based solutions in San Francisco, as well as in Louisiana, where they're restoring many of their natural wetlands, it's also really important to address how people move away from low-lying areas to higher ground. And in Louisiana, I was very impressed to learn more about the LA Safe project, which is working in parishes across southern Louisiana and coming up with solutions to either create more floodable parks along their edge, but sometimes it's important that communities actually have the chance to move away. And with the indigenous people that were removed from their ancestral lands and then settled on in Ile de Jean Charles, you know, now that land is now disappearing into the Gulf of Mexico. And so in that case, there was a real interest in creating economic models to move an entire community, so that it wasn't a piecemeal system where there were buyouts and some people took them and some people didn't, and it created this irregular pattern. They were interested in experimenting with how to move an entire community and how to have that community direct the process.
It is fascinating what's going on around the country, and thankfully you have captured some of the most interesting and innovative projects. As you remind us, it's not possible to rebuild our cities root and branch, but rather one block, one park, house, neighborhood at a time. At the end of the book, you have a conclusion, a path forward, and I started with something that was rather pessimistic from Tom Friedman. Help us to be more optimistic. You've seen some of the best of what's going on in America. How hopeful are you?
I'm very hopeful. I think we have a great opportunity ahead of us to not only direct our attention to mitigating and adapting to climate change, but also to creating more equitable and livable cities at the same time. I think we have a chance to use this as an opportunity to make things much better.
Well, I like to hear that. Now, you've probably incited a lot of thought on the part of people about what's going on in my community, or how can I get started with a project in my neighborhood, whatever it may be. What is the best way tactically for somebody who's motivated as a result of this conversation?
Well, there are projects going on in communities all over the country, many of which resemble those that I've addressed in the book. And I would strongly encourage people to get involved in what's going on in their local communities to address any of the parts that I discussed in the book, from reclaiming our streets to creating more porous cities to planting them up with trees and adapting our shorelines. Although it sounds simplistic, if there was one thing someone could do, probably the best thing you could do is get out of your car. And the reason for that, again, is that it lowers transportation emissions, which, as you pointed out, are a huge part of the problem we need to solve. And it also frees up space to do more with our cities, much more. And I think that's one of the things we need to try and do most of now, is to figure out how the decisions that we make in our personal lives can affect the benefit of everyone in cities.
Well, this is a great guide. It really is. From the ground up, local efforts to create resilient cities. Allison Sant, congratulations on the book and all the work that you're doing in San Francisco on the ground to really actualize and realize that which you talk about in the book. I thank you so much for being part of America Trends.
And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.